Welcome to Real Stories, a show that has honest conversations from the heart. I invite you to sit back, relax, and allow our guests to speak their truth.
Hello, I'm Taylor, the Communication Doctor, and welcome to Real Stories. I just want to say, I come from a family where people didn't always speak their truth. And I think it's so important to speak their truth. And every day I meet people who, because of society, are just walking with that facade because they feel that it is the way to be. And in Real Stories, I want people to know the real story behind the facade. And that is why I do what I do. Hi, this is Real Stories, and I am your host, Tanya the Communication Doctor. And today on my show, I have Valerie Lewis, who is a personal growth facilitator. Hello, Valerie.
Hi, Tanya. Thanks for having me on this show. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's brilliant. I'm really, really excited to talk to you because I feel like I'm doing something really special, and I'm also... These shows, I'm going to do about two or three of them, are in tribute to my parents as well, and the Windrush generation.
Yeah.
And the reason that I've reached out to you, Valerie, is because I've realised that you're one of the children of the Windrush generation. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to speak to you in terms of having that direct experience in terms of witnessing things that your parents have done, or things that your parents have experienced. And your experience in turn, in terms of having, you know, being one of those children of what that generation that came to this country.
Yeah.
So my first kind of question to you is, what was your parents' first impression when they came to England?
Well, I asked my mom, I said, how did you feel? And she came, I think it's in the summer. She came in June. And it was nice and hot. So in some ways, I think she was probably, you know, nervous because she actually traveled over on her own because her mum had come over the year before. Mm. And with her cousin and went to live in Birmingham. And my dad had also traveled out the year before. This was 1955. And he went to London because he'd got a brother who had also come out and he was living there. So I think she came over on her own. She flew over on her own and she was probably nervous and excited. And it was a summer, but she did say by the winter, she was almost thinking, I'm not sure, you know, that was the only time that she felt to herself, I want to go home. Mm. You know, wow. I mean, that was the only time. But in terms of, in those days, it was easy to get work. She actually got work, and they lived in lodgings. She did eventually end up the following year moving to Trowbridge in Wiltshire,
yeah.
Because Dad had moved down there and told her there was work down there. So he moved down there first, and then she moved down, and then they got married down there in Wiltshire. And they lived in lodgings. I know Mom said that the first lodgings they lived together in, I suppose as a married couple, the landlord was Polish, and she said he was really nice. They lived in several lodgings after that because eventually they moved up to Sheffield, which is my hometown. They moved up to Sheffield because her mom had moved up to Sheffield and said, oh, you know, come. There's, you know, you can get another job here. So they ended up moving up to Sheffield and got work. And I think in terms of the lodging, I suppose they ended up not being happy with lodging. So they decided to buy their own place because I suppose by then they were wanting to start a family.
So what was lodgings like? It's interesting that word, I've not heard that term being used, is it the one room where they lodging in the world? They're all in
it's
one
basically
room.
Basically, a house. Maybe somebody's renting out a house and they're renting out rooms, and maybe you share the kitchen.
Yes.
And so what you found was because a lot of people had come over, people tended to go to the areas where they knew other people, you know, where maybe friends had already gone. And so you ended up with a house where there were, you know, maybe four or five people that knew each other.
Yes, yeah.
And in some ways, I suppose that was the companionship and closeness that, you know, that they had. I suppose if there was anything negative, at least they had someone to share it with.
Yes, yeah, no. You know what? It's so interesting because it's a similar thing with my parents. And they came over from Jamaica, is that right, Valerie?
That's right, yes.
Yeah, it's the same with my parents, come over from Jamaica, but... I know what my mum stayed with her sister first, and then my dad was stayed with his uncle. But I suppose that's a little bit later. But I know, I think from my uncle's generation, they must have experienced where they had to live with other people, like you say, the lodgings in, and everything's in one room. And when I imagine that, like a whole living in one room, it must have been really tough, you know, yeah. Really tough. Especially, you know, you get a certain point in your life, it's. Thing. But you know what's really fascinating was the way that generation brought houses, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know, for example, the partner was something that regularly happened. So with the partner, various people would put money in and help each other every
month.
So did you have that same experience? Do you want to explain that to my audience because of how that works? Because I feel that for me that's just so courageous. And
I'm assuming that they did the same thing, because I do remember sort of people talking about partner, you know, as I was growing up. Basically somebody would be, you know, one person probably would be in charge, and then everybody would contribute so much, give so much of their money to one person, and then It would be like a circle.
Yeah.
Everybody would put some money into a pot, and then it would go to one person, and then maybe the following month or whatever, it would go to another. That same amount would go to another person, and so gradually, it's rather than having a bank account, I suppose.
I thought it was clever. I thought it was so.
No interest on it. you know, over time, that's your way of saving your money, and when people did that, they were able to, as you say, maybe buy a house or help somebody out who wanted to come over, you know, because what happens is maybe one person came over first,
yes.
They got work, settled down, and then they would send for a brother or a sister.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, to bring the family together. And I suppose
bring the family together.
Yeah. And what's interesting, I suppose, you know, recently been in the news over the last, you know, for a long time, really, where people have realised that they've come over, or some family members are sent for. This didn't happen in my family, I just know from the news. And then some people are deported and told they can't come back to the country. I mean, what did you think about that whole scandal? That was kind of, when I heard about that, I thought, wow, I mean, my parents had passports and they travelled. I think my mum especially was quite well travelled.
Yes.
Not when she was younger, but when she got older, she should have been to Africa, Morocco, various different places. Mm-hmm. But it is so interesting, you know, to think that some people, you know, they've worked so hard, they didn't actually have a British passport. I mean, what's your feelings on that, Valerie, at that sort of time?
That is very, very sad. I think a lot of that is with the children.
Yes.
You know, that parents, if they came over, maybe they sent for their children.
Mm.
And the children would have been sort of, you know, toddlers maybe. They came over and they would have had paperwork, but then sometimes if you as years go by, maybe not all that, if people moved, maybe not all that paperwork got saved, because as far as they were concerned, they were British, they'd come from the Commonwealth, so they had a right to be here because, you know, we were invited to come over.
Yes.
And do the jobs that, because they needed the labour. Yeah. So if they sent for their children, as far as they were concerned, the children were okay. It's not until this, you know, this law came in place that they had to prove it. And then by that time, they haven't got any paperwork.
Yeah.
And a lot of them probably didn't have they didn't have a passport, or, you know, because the passport, unless they'd sort of travelled and got a British passport, their passport would have expired.
Yes. Yes, I just think that's just incredible.
It's just horrendous.
Yeah. And it's interesting what you just said there in terms of, you know, there was a certain pride, wasn't there? People that come from the Commonwealth, there's a sort of there was a pride in the West Indies of being British, you know, mm-hmm. and being part of the Commonwealth. and it must have been like a slap in the face to come to this country, being so proud to be part of this Commonwealth, and for some people to experience racism. What kind of struggles did your parents face in terms of racism when they came to this country?
Well, with my mom, I don't know whether I think sometimes they're trying to read between the lines. Maybe it's a case of somebody might say something, but then maybe you don't take it on board, because you want peace. Yeah. Because I know she referred to one time when she was worked in hospitals as an auxiliary, working in hospitals. She goes, it was more the patients. Yeah. Rather than, because she says that she's always, wherever she's worked, she's always got on with her co-workers. Mm. She said it was more the patients, I suppose, once they come out of operation or if they were in pain or whatever, they would say, why don't you effing go back home? Wow. On your banana boat?
Yeah.
And I said, Mom, what did you say? And she says, oh, they were sick and confused.
For the banana boat, did you say?
Yeah.
so it's not to laugh, it's just ridiculous, isn't it, really, things that people say, isn't it? Go back, yeah, on the banana boat. Wow.
I thought, that is so hurtful.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they wouldn't, I don't think they'd be able to say that now and get away with it. But, you just think, well, did they put up with things then because it was a case of, well, who would you report it to? And you just want to get on with life. Mm. I don't know.
It is interesting because I think there is kind of an innate kind of subservient behaviour of that generation, because they must have had to put up with so much.
Yeah.
That they just had to suppress it because it's almost like they couldn't believe it was happening on some level. You just need to get on with life, didn't you? You need to push.
That's right, yeah. Because, yes, that's it. And once you start having children and you've got a family, you're working, aren't you? Yes. And basically, both my parents worked. It wasn't a case of one could afford not,
Yes.
So your time spent bringing up your children, working, and, trying to keep a home, and also keep up with, see your relatives, see your relatives when you can.
So what commitments, did they have any commitments, like, other than children? Did they have commitments back home? Did they have to send money back home to the family, or?
Yes, they did. Because my grandmother, she went back. This is my mum's mother.
Yeah.
She said her dad was supposed to come over at the same time, but I think he was quite asthmatic. So he ended up staying in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. So eventually my grandmother went back to Jamaica. But I do know, in time, the other siblings came over, apart from one brother. But mom would be sending money back home, and likewise with, my dad had some brothers out there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think that's such a responsibility, and I always knew that happened. But when my parents passed away, and I started to read some of their letters, I was like, wow, what a pressure for, because my parents got married when they were 22.
Yeah.
22 years old to be working, but must have been, they weren't earning that much.
No.
Support their family.
Yeah.
Must support the family back home. I thought, even just reading some letters, they were all so positive. The letters are all so positive, though.
Yeah.
But I feel like there must have been a struggle as well, especially for a man. A man has a responsibility anyway of that generation.
Yes.
And have that extra responsibility to provide.
Mm-hmm. And they're still doing it now. People are still doing, that generation is still doing it now.
Mm.
Because what happens, I mean, for example, say my mum, her younger brother, he died and he had children.
Yes.
So every now and again, my mum would send something over.
Mm.
They still end up years later helping somebody out.
Contributing, yeah.
Contributing, yeah.
Just what beautiful people. That's how I see it. When I look at that, I just feel like there's so much unity there. Like, looking back at the partner, everyone pulling together to help each other, build their families, to buy houses, to support their family back home. I just feel like it's just remarkable, isn't there?
And what I love as well about that generation, well, I'm just looking at my mom, for example. I mean, my dad passed away in 97, but my mom's got quite a lot of cousins in Birmingham.
And they're
very close.
Yes.
You know, I can't believe how close they are, you know? So if she goes down to Birmingham, some will come, you know, because her sister lives down there, my auntie. Mm. Other cousins will come, you know? And I mean, obviously over the past few years, because they're of that generation, people are dying. But they all go to each other, you know, that everybody will come to the funeral.
Yeah.
I think to myself, in some ways, we haven't maintained that same link, say like with our cousins, if you like.
No, same here. I feel the same myself, actually. It does sadden me a little bit when I think about it. And it's interesting you mentioned Birmingham, because I think there's a lot of Jamaicans in Birmingham. I've got a lot of family in Birmingham myself, and I remember going there as a child and just going to different people's houses, and they'd live like one street from another street, and I'd just be so full from eating, because yeah, you'd have to be polite, because, you know, it'd be rude not to say no to not to eat for that person. So you'd eat about three dinners. I remember we were only little, but I used to love it. I thought, we're going to get some dried dumpling and ackee and all the great, you know, West Indian food, you know, because I loved it as a kid. Real community in Birmingham, a real kind of loving community. And they live like they do, because they cook like they do in Jamaica in Birmingham. They don't so much do that in London. I don't know what it's like, but...
No. I know, probably not so much my mom, but my auntie. She still has people popping round and relatives popping round, or people popping round, and there's always food. Mm. But I do think... I suppose because of what they've been through, they've maintained that contact. They've got a shared history. And which, even though, which I just think is just special. Yeah. And you won't see, I just feel you won't see that again, will you?
What do you think happened with that? I mean...
I think it's just the same as in the wider society, really. People disperse and go and move off and live here and there and everywhere. And we just don't maintain those bonds. The world's a lot, it's kind of like the world's a lot bigger. And we're just more spread out. I mean, my family, my immediate family, we're very close. We're close to, you know, aunties. And as I've gotten older, I appreciate my aunties and uncles more, you know, because I think you go through your younger years, and you're close to them, but then you're getting on with your life. And then it's not until you reached a certain age and you thought, well, you know, they're older now, and I want to see more of them.
Yes. Yeah, that makes sense. And it's lovely that you are connecting in that sort of a way, because I do think it's a shame with some families, you know, when you do lose that bond. I don't know what it is, if it is that, you know, you said people are thinking of themselves, it is that people are not looking out for each other. There's a bit more selfish behavior rather than community behavior, do you know,
in
the
world.
And is that the Western culture that has influenced us in a negative way?
It possibly is.
Just quite interesting, because I know I've experienced that myself. But what was your experience then, from that perspective, seeing that? What was your experience growing up?
I suppose we were probably, if you like, because of that, the community that we grew up in, we were probably kind of sheltered in a way.
Yeah.
Because of that community. And as I said, apart from at school, and I do remember though, in my first, when I started working, I feel that some of the people there hadn't seen a black person before. Well, they had seen a black person, but they hadn't really spent time with a black person.
Yeah.
I was the first black person they got to know as such. And I think one or two of them probably were guarded. And I think they had an image in their mind, because I do remember one woman saying to me, she goes, she liked me because I hadn't got a chip on my shoulder.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. you know? And then I do, and I also remember, because it was client facing. Mm-hmm. So I used to answer the telephone and people would come in. It was BSN driving school. People would come in. And I do remember sometimes thinking they look a bit surprised.
Yeah, to see.
And I do remember one or two saying, oh, I didn't realize, you were black, or what, I can't think what the word, we didn't call people black then, did we? I didn't realize you were colored.
Yes. And,
Didn't sound like you were colored. And I thought, well, what's a colored person supposed to sound like? Yeah.
Oh, dear. No, it's so interesting, isn't it, really? That's so commonly in terms of, you know, this idea of, oh, you're black, but they say, oh, you're, you know, oh, you're coloured, as you quite rightly said. That's interesting. But how did that affect you? Do you feel that's affected you, or would you feel that you had to be subservient in some ways?
I think at the time, looking back, I think I probably didn't know how to react.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because what can you say?
Yeah.
I mean, I'd probably react very differently now. But back then it was, you know, in the 70s, it was like, well, what do you say?
Yeah.
You know? And, if like me and my sisters, we wore our hairstyles a certain way, because that was when people were getting into hair extensions and things. Yeah. Oh, is that your real hair? You know, that type of thing. And, oh, can you wash it? And, you know, silly, you know, those sort of comments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was fascination in that comment.
It was interesting. But what was also interesting was when I met the person who became my husband, I'm divorced, my ex-husband. He grew up in, he was black, and he grew up in a different neighbourhood to me. Oh. He grew up in a black neighbourhood.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was about the same time that people were getting into reggae music, and there was a lot of Rastafarian type music.
Yeah, yeah.
And he liked that sort of stuff. And a lot of the youths at that time were dressing a certain way. Mm. They sort of knotted up, they didn't have locks, but they'd knot up their hair, or had, you know, not comb it, if you like. and they would wear tams.
What's caps. The same as tams?
It's like a peaked cap.
Yeah.
But it sometimes had red, green and gold colours in it.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Yeah.
And they'd sort of adopted this walk, and they wore stay pressed trousers, and they'd have a hanky hanging out their back pocket.
Yeah.
And a lot of youths dressed like that.
Mm.
And I remember him being stopped. I remember one occasion that he told me about, he was walking down one of the roads near where he lived, and I think a couple of coppers and a couple of policemen, and this man, the man ran up to him and he said, it's him. And he hadn't done anything, but they insisted on taking him to to the police station.
Wow.
And they held him.
Mm.
Mm. And he kept saying, you know, I want my dad. Yeah. And so they started mimicking, oh, he wants his daddy. But anyway, they ended up, you know, phoning his dad, and his dad came down, and obviously it wasn't, you know, it was proved that it wasn't him. But when we were married and we got our house, and we had a car, we used to get stopped a few times.
Mm.
You know, because it was almost like, oh, the young black couple, they've got a car.
Yeah.
Again, this was sort of like early 80s. Oh, they've got a car. Mm. You know, so he'd have to, oh, is this your car? Have you got your license on you? You know, and if he hadn't got his license on, you know, can you present it at the police station within 7 days? So it was that, those were the sort of things that went off then, if you like.
Yeah. It's interesting you say then, because I feel they're still.
They're still going on. Yeah. They're still going on, because it's interesting, because last year, my brother, both my brothers are over 50 now.
Yeah.
One of them, he said it was, what was it? He'd finished work early. It was in the summer, and he decided to walk it home from work. he likes walking. And he said he got stopped by a couple of policemen. And they said, oh, you look as if you've got drugs on you.
Wow.
I know.
Ooh. So I just breathe through. Yeah.
So they basically, and because I've just finished with it. So they said, well, can, you know, we want to search your bag. So they searched his bag, and obviously they didn't find anything. You know, and they let him go, but he said they didn't even apologise.
Wow. You know, that's the sort of things that go on, really. And it's disgusting, like you say, it's over 15. It's bad enough they're stopping the young people, because I think it's even worse because they're more vulnerable as well, you know, the young boys that are stopped.
Yeah.
Done nothing, and they're vulnerable, and when you walk past and you see young boys, you know, and they might be just wearing a tracksuit, and some of the boys would be totally innocent. Mm-hmm. People are walking past. I remember seeing that just because I'm here in Hackney, and I remember just the other, not the other day, probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago, seeing a group of boys that were stopped, and as I was walking, there was a couple that were coming towards me. I could hear them saying, "Oh, so it's the gangs again, it's the gangs again," and I'm thinking, wow. What an expulsion.
Yeah.
Who says they're in the gang? You don't know, you know, but you're seeing black boys in a hoodie, so they must be part of a gang, or they must be. And these boys are so young.
I know.
And it's just shocking, isn't it, really? Because sometimes they're just innocent. And it's seeing the innocence and not seeing the, because it's like we're looking at people, they're looking at their colour, looking at young black boys, and they're making the assumption that they're bad.
That's because they're dressed a certain way.
Yeah.
And because there's more than one of them.
Exactly. And I just feel that is such a struggle, or must be such a struggle for a black man. I mean, a black woman, I think it's a struggle as well, but I think there's just another different level there of racism. And it's interesting you said your brother, and your brother was in his 50s and he stopped. That makes that, again, it's just like, you know, so he could be carrying drugs. I mean, it's just ridiculous, really. Isn't
because
it?
He's got a rucksack.
Yeah. No. I totally get it. You know, I had a stop and search when I was in my early 20s with a rucksack.
Really?
Rucksack, yeah, in Westminster. Because I used to do fitness and dancing, but so I was going all through the city looking very casual, I suppose, when everybody else is suited and booted. Mm-hmm. And I got stopped and it was horrible. Wow. When you talk about it, it's such a horrible situation, horrible for me as a woman to have gone through that.
Yes.
It was just disgusting, really. But then they just let you go. Like I say, no one apologises, no one says anything, and they just let you go, you know? Like nothing.
I think that's the worst thing, isn't it? Not apologising.
Mm.
I mean, it's bad enough being stopped, but the fact that, no, you know, you don't have an apology.
Yes, exactly. Like, so I'm sorry, or you know mm-hmm. I thought you were someone else, or we're searching, even if it's procedure, whatever it is, it's just almost like mm-hmm. treating you like you are so less than, and making
it's
you
almost like less than. It's almost like you're guilty before, you know, before you've had a chance to sort of prove that you're not.
That's it. And those wounds stay with you. They stay with you.
Yeah.
With you. They affect you in terms of, you may get up and have that resilience, but the wounds are still there and they go deep. And I think that's probably why I wanted to have these conversations, just to let people know, to kind of just show the beauty of the experience as well. And you see the racism, but also the innocence of people as well. Yeah. The assumptions that are made, and in some ways it's unconscious biased behaviour. There's lots of that. But just to lighten it up, what was one of your most fondest memories, like growing up in this country? And, you know, what was one of your most fondest memories of your parents?
I think Christmas.
Yeah.
With my dad, because, you know, because dad was quite strict.
Mm.
But he could be funny. we liked Christmas. Christmas was nice because you're all together, and then you'd usually go and visit a relative on Boxing Day or something like that. Mm. So I think it was just the family bonds that I liked. And I think I liked, if I look back now, I like that we were, I'm quite close in age to my brothers and sisters, and we played together. And I mean, obviously there's a period in time where you almost don't have anything in common with them, because you feel as if you're a lot older or whatever. Mm-hmm. But looking back, we used to play games together. And it's really funny because one of the games we used to play, we used to mimic our mother. Because we used to find it fascinating because they didn't speak Patois at home necessarily. Oh. They might do if they were with relatives, but not with us.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so we used to like going to the market with mom.
Yeah.
Because you'd have all the black women there doing their shopping. And, you know, that's where they got their yam from and whatever. So we'd be mimicking, you know, we'd play these games at home where we'd be mimicking them. Yeah. I think my happiest memories really was that really I didn't have a bad childhood. It, you know, I was lucky. I had family and also friends in that area that I grew up in.
And that's important, isn't it, really? Those kind of like the simple things, the connection with family, the laughs, the jokes, and it's appreciating all of that, really, isn't it? Because I think I'm the same. It wasn't until my parents passed I looked back, because before, you know, you always want this, want that, and then actually you feel like you see the beauty, don't you, in appreciating some of those memories, simple memories of just having the family together and being together.
Together,
which is quite lovely. Mm-hmm. What would you say, what are your learnings that you got from your parents, like from that generation? What would you say, like being a daughter of someone who came from, you know, from Jamaica, that generation came over to this country, built a life for themselves, and you witnessed that as their daughter. What would you say is one of your biggest learnings from, you know, that you've got and well, that you kind of carry through in your life?
I think if I look at my parents, They're relatively calm people. Mm. And I'd like to think that, you know, I've got that in me as well. Mm. And I think trying to have a balanced viewpoint on situations, not to jump straight in, but to try and stand back and assess a situation. Mm. And to treat people basically how you would want to be treated.
Yeah,
very much so. Mm-hmm. I mean, we learned to be quite self because both parents worked, and I was the oldest. I suppose I learned how to be quite self-sufficient, you know, because I think West Indian parents of that generation were probably quite strict.
Yeah.
So you learned to do chores, you know. And once they started, you know, if you had a big family, everybody had to learn how to do something. So you all chipped in. You learned how to cook. You learned how to keep the place tidy, and you kept yourself tidy.
Yeah.
You know, so I think those are sort of things that carried through with us, that we carried through.
As you say that, I remember my job was cleaning it because I'm the youngest of six. So the opposite of the oldest.
It's funny because I'm the oldest of six.
Oh, are you? Oh, okay. So the opposite side. And
yeah.
My job was to clean the ornaments. And you know what it's like in West India?
That was a Sunday job in our house.
So there's a lot of ornaments to clean. I remember that. But yeah, no, you're right. That kind of, I love what you just said there, having a balanced viewpoint. And I look back and I think they must have been strict. They're so strict for a reason. Because the strictness, it's almost like protection, wasn't it? I mean, I think some people don't understand it, but the culture I've experienced may not have understood, so your parents are strict or may not have understood it. But I feel in some ways it was a real protecting. They were trying to, because they went through so much, and like they may have disclosed what they've gone through or not, but there's a protection there.
There's a protection there. And I don't think, I know certainly from my dad, he probably didn't want us to go through some of what he went through, the hardships that he'd gone through in life.
Yeah.
You know, because he was always on about education.
Mm.
I think they just saw education as a way to progress, if you like. And basically, keeping yourself out of trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think that generation, or the people that I knew anyway, it seemed very important to them not to get into trouble.
Yes, you're right. Yes, exactly.
You know, so maybe that might have impacted on how, if somebody was maybe racist to them, they didn't want to cause trouble.
Mm.
Yeah. Or maybe because they knew what might happen. I don't know, you know.
But yes, exactly. There must be some wisdom there.
Yeah.
That experience and why they're so strict. And just before, I wanted to share, we were talking before about men, because I've done a lot of work before with young offenders in the past and mental health and men. And it is interesting how, you know, black men, I do think, have it the hardest.
Yeah. And
I just think, looking back, it must have been really hard. Well, I know, I realise with my father, he never spoke about racism, you know, in that kind of a way. He'd speak to me about, like, Muhammad Ali, because he loved Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
And, you know, he'd talk about Malcolm X and Martin. He loved Martin Luther King. He used to have the I Have a Dream vinyl.
Oh.
And listen to that. Mm-hmm. But actually, in terms of my mum told me about her experiences, which I find quite interesting, but I suppose that's another podcast. but Dad never really did speak about his personal kind of experience of racism.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it was because it was too painful. Would you say the same with your father?
I think so. I mean, in some ways, it seemed as if Dad was quiet. But yes, he could be talkative. But yes, he probably kept his feelings, you know, what was deep down inside to him. And I suppose it's only as I've got older now, I just wish I could go back and ask him things. Yeah. I mean, next time I go up to Sheffield, I'll, you know, sit and ask, you know, speak to my uncle, you know, my dad's brother, you know, just to find, I'll try and sort of, you know, find out more from him, what his experiences, you know, were.
Because in some ways, they just must have been too painful to talk about.
Yeah.
That's just my guess, really. And then in some ways, you know, they bring you up a certain way, they're very strict of you, but the other side is they just want to protect you and look after you. And don't want you to experience some of the things that they experience. And
yeah,
I suppose another reason why me doing this podcast, everything that's happened, and some of this with the police stopping young people, stopping people, you know, just stopping black people. It's still going on now until this day. We're in 2020.
Well, that's right. Yeah, because I mean, the SUS laws, were they in the 80s, and then they revoked them, didn't they? But it still exists. I haven't got any children because I lost my daughter, but I worry about my nephews and nieces. Just think, and when they reached a certain age, when they were in their teens and they were going out, I used to think, oh god, I hope they'd be all right. I know people, you know, worry about their children, but I think I worried because I know that they're black and all sorts of things can happen.
Yes, exactly, and so it doesn't go away, does it, really? And I suppose, you know, I hope for a better world every day. You know, I hope for a better world or an understanding, and I think it's important for people to have these conversations, which I feel maybe in the past we didn't have enough of. Maybe I feel that there's some things that maybe we might have had, or I might have spoken about racism and stuff that's happened within my community or with my family. But actually, I think it's really important to speak to the wider community about that and educate people who are not of colour, you know, educate white people, educate, you know, Asian, let them know what our experiences are. So then they maybe can look at things in a very different way.
Yeah.
So that's the only way that we grow.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Oh, I'm going to bring it to a close here, but is there any kind of inspiring, wise words that you'd like to leave us with, Valerie?
No. I have noticed, I mean, I think it's really lovely that the younger generation, the millennials,
yes,
if you like, are carrying the torch.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying so hard to activate, and there's a lot of anti-racist activists or specialists, if you like, that I've come across on Instagram. So I'm learning too.
Yeah,
because even language, you know, what we call people or the terms that we use, it changes over time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's an education for me. It's an education for me in terms of sort of looking at myself and say, you know, asking myself if I've got any biases, you know? Yes. And I think that's what we all need to be doing, regardless of what colour we are or what you know, what our nationality is for everybody to examine their biases.
Yes.
And how we relate to people, how we treat them.
And I had that same conversation earlier on today, actually, in an interview, because I was saying that if you're not aware of yourself, then how can you say anything or how can you preach? But I'm with you with the millennials. Some of them are amazing. I love that. That's what's kind of pushed me. I thought, gosh, I've got to step up. I've got to step up my game. I've got to speak out. I can't. If something happens, I'm going to talk about it. I put something out on Instagram recently because I experienced something horrible, which you can go to Instagram if you want to listen to. but these, just to let people know that it's not, these are things that are happening every single day. And just, I suppose I'm letting people know what these things happen, but I still don't judge everybody with the same brush.
Yeah.
And I think that's my reason for doing that. And just, I feel if I do that, hopefully it's modeling that behavior as, you know, that I've experienced a lot. I've experienced racism in my life. I was traveling a lot when I was dancing and acting and traveling all over the country. I was called a lot of names, often the only black person in the theater company.
Yeah.
So I've experienced it. My God. And I never spoke about it. I would spoke about it to like my friends or people close to me, but I never spoke about it in terms of the wider sense. And now we have social media, and I feel it's an education in itself to realise that, you know, words hurt. Words are sometimes worse than eating because they stay with you, don't they? You know? Yeah. Let's bring it to a close. But it's lovely speaking to you, Valerie.
Thank you as well, Tania.
Really lovely.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Thank you. I'm just going to say from Taylor the Communication Doctor and from Valerie Lewis, adios. One of my takeaways from the show is that we need to have more conversations, more reality in terms of real conversations, less desensitizing, less suppression of the truth. Because if we suppress the truth and we suppress these experiences, which I feel has happened in the past, I feel that affects us moving forward. So we need to have these conversations. We need to not be embarrassed about some of the things that are happening with regards to racism. And to change the world, these conversations will help other people to understand what the current situation is. Because racism hasn't gone away. But to improve it, we need to talk about it. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to learn more, please visit our website at communicationdoctor.co.uk. To listen to more real stories, don't forget to subscribe.